To Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love people who love cats and dogs, which is what this show is all about. I'm grateful to be on the NPR station Peconic Public Broadcasting, where this show originated and has continued for 14 years and over 650 consecutive shows. To download any episode, go to RadioPetLady.com. And for information about my New York Dog and Cat Film Festivals, which travel the country year-round, benefiting a local animal welfare group at every location, go to catfilmfestival.com and dogfilmfestival.com. Tickets are now on sale for the November 3rd premieres in New York City of the 5th Annual Dog Film Festival and 3rd Annual Cat Film Festival, which will sell out. I'll be there in person to greet you. Both festivals are on Sunday, November 3rd. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes foods for cats and small dogs in a human food facility with ingredients that are good enough for people to eat. They have always respected the nutritional needs of cats as obligate carnivores and don't make any dry food for cats, putting human-grade proteins in their cans and pouches with a wide assortment of recipes to entice even the most finicky felines and persnickety pooches. This show is also made possible by Dr. Elsie's, a privately owned company founded and run by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado, who has devoted his career to personally creating specialized litters to meet the needs of every sort of cat. Now available at select Target, Walmart, and other major retailers nationwide, you can try their veterinarian-formulated litter for free with a rebate on their website that refunds your first purchase. All proceeds for the month of October go to the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation to find a cure for this cancer. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding and continuing sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival. My guests today are Alexandra Horowitz with her fantastic new book, Our Dogs, Ourselves. She's going to be with me for a double session. And then Sean Cassells will be here with his hilarious movie, Bitches at the Beach, set in the Hamptons. It's going to be in the 5th Annual New York Dog Film Festival, November 3rd, and is such a funny movie with these two dogs as the stars with a voiceover. You're going to love it. The good news is Alexandra Horowitz, How She Has Time, I Can't Imagine, has written yet another dog book, to my mind, the greatest one she has attempted yet. It's called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. And what's remarkable about the book, from my perspective, is that you look at the table of contents, you go, I think I know what that chapter will be about. And you start to read it and you think I know where she's going. And she goes so much further and so much deeper than you ever could imagine. If you own a dog, ever owned a dog, and are thinking of owning a dog, this book is something it would really behoove you to read before you do it so you can be a better person. Alexandra, welcome back to the show and congratulations from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, thank you so much, Tracy.
I guess when we talk about you being a pioneer in the studying of dogs with the Canine Cognition Lab at Barnard, which is named after you, I've always thought of you as a scientist, a social scientist with some of your books, but you really are a social moralist, and I didn't fully get that until this book. Do you feel that you've taken up a kind of crusade on behalf of dogs that maybe as time has passed and you've seen more and more of how people think about dogs and interact with them, you feel you really need to be speaking up and out for them more than ever?
I think it is interesting. Something like that has happened. I mean, I consider myself an observer of behavior. That's what I professionally do, and that's the scientific side of it. I'm observing dog behavior, and then insofar as I'm writing on it, I'm conveying what I observe. Along the way, I think some of that conveyance turns a little bit into recommendations for how one could live with dogs. that takes their perceptual abilities, their cognitive abilities, their kind of needs as canids into account. And I think you're right to say that at some level, I've gone even a little further with this book and become just an advocate for dogs here. For me, it's just a smooth move, transition from being an observer and saying what I see to sort of saying what I think dogs need or what I hope our society starts thinking about dogs. But yeah, I think you make a good observation there. It's a change.
It's a change, and it's one you've been headed towards with your work. I remember in one of the books you were talking about sitting quietly with one of your dogs as he got older, and you couldn't go on walks anymore, but you sat quietly and let him look and smell and just see the world. It was probably the book about smell, and it made me realize that you already were very sensible of the fact that the dog has a whole array of experiences of the world that we're often too busy or too self-absorbed to stop and think about. I feel as if this book, you've become a moralist in the truest sense, but a historical one, because you are an academic. And I mean that very positively. You look at information, you gather information, you research it. The way you present it back to us in this book really brings me up short. Now, you have a book, a chapter in the book on breeding. Mm-hmm. So I think, well, you're going to say a few things about we've ruined the German Shepherd and the short-faced dogs. But it's really much deeper than that. When you sat down in the AKC library to look back at the history of what humans have done to create these beasts, were you yourself pretty astounded by what you came upon? Because what you offer us in that chapter astounds me.
Yeah, I was, because I, like you would expect, came in with, you know, a scientific and a knowledgeable dog person, in this case, a knowledgeable scientist dog person's understanding of problems with pure breeding, a little bit of the history of pure breeding, and then furthermore, just some urge, just a little bit urge to have more, right? But I didn't know what I would find. I didn't know the complete history. I didn't know how little I knew about the history there. And I think, and very much, I think just the presentation of that, just the presentation of it comes across as striking, right? I mean, in most of my chapters, I'm not making moral judgments about how we should live with dogs. I'm pointing out how we do live with dogs now and sort of where it came from, and then pointing the question at us and saying, okay, if this is where we came from, what do we want to do here?
Right.
And so, yeah, that you're seeing my process. You're seeing my surprise. And,
yes.
And I'm glad if it moves somebody else who's so knowledgeable about thinking about our history with dogs to be surprised as well.
Well, good. You did that. And and when I said moralizing, I don't want someone to think, oh, I'm not going to read the book because I really, really love my Maltese dog. And so I don't want her to tell me that's not a good thing to love. You don't in any way moralize. This is not a book by a vegetarian telling people not to eat animals and why and how at all.
Right.
It's not, it doesn't have that. So I don't mean to put it that way. It's that you are looking, you really have turned your cognition lab back towards the people and watching them, not judging, not criticizing, but a mirror back to us of who we are with our dogs. And some of it is so funny, Alexandra. I have to ask you to read a little bit from the chapter about talking to our dogs, because I'm sure if somebody, well, supposedly someone is watching us all the time these days, right? But if the little doodad from Google is listening, I talk to my dogs pretty much nonstop, and I've never stopped to think how completely peculiar it is. And you have captured, as a social scientist, dialogue, and you live in a very rich place to do your accidental research, because you live a lot of time on the streets of New York. And your depiction of what people were saying and then description of what the dog and the person were doing at the time is so funny, just as the chapter on breeding and the one particularly about desexing, other issues, is chilling. It's like a historical perspective And we're in the midst of an unfolding history. It's all moving quickly. You know, they used to live in the backyard. They're in our bed. But have we stopped to think about any of it? You know, how? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? How are we doing it? Just to lighten it up a little before we go on to some of the more deep things that you talk about, can you pick some of them to read aloud? They're so funny. Yes. Please.
Yeah. I have my favorites.
Oh, good. Do those.
Well, so one of the things I did, and as you say, this was very much kind of what could scientifically be called eavesdropping on people, my just walking on the streets and realizing how much we were talking to our dogs. And I, like you, talk to my dogs all the time. So I'm not judging people because I find it actually very charming and delightful. But I wanted to kind of categorize how people were talking to their dogs. So, you know, one category is like the mom commentary on behavior where they're just, you know, their eyes are always on you and they see everything. And I do comment on some, those are mostly women actually, but some men do this kind of, you know, slight reprimand. And so some of them are from that category. One is, be nice. When you get tired, you get nasty. That's a man to rambunctiously playing dog. Here's another. Okay, I got it, kiddo. I can definitely hear that. It's coming any minute now. Almost there. It's very exciting. Man to dog howling for a treat. That's one of my favorites.
It's divine.
Then there are a lot of great kind of cheering squad ones.
Yes.
You know, where people are kind of encouraging their dogs along. So here's one from that. Come on, you made it the whole way. One more step. Man on top step to puppy sprawled on second to last step. and then there are instructions. So, you know, not the normal instructions like to sit or come, but the types of things where people are giving a command, but they're often really improbable commands. So one is, okay, you guys, share. Man to two dogs being given a plate to lick clean. I don't know.
I do that all the time. Do you not do that? All the time. Good girls. Nice sharing. Good sharing, girls. Oh, my God. I talk them through every plate they share.
You're kind of a cheering squad. Yeah. Here's one. If you make it to the end of the fence, you get a biscuit. If you lie down, no biscuits. Women to corgi who's probably not going to make it to the end of the fence. I think this is one that everybody has said this one. Go get the ball. Get the ball. Get that. Okay, I'll get it. Woman to non-retrieving retriever. And this is one that's very, like a really implausible one is probably the classic one. Come on, be a man. Man with baseball hat and bulldog being sniffed. You know, that really captures what we're asking of our dogs. We're asking them to be men. Anyway, so those are some of
they're so funny because there's one after another, and it's not only the comment that the person's making to the dog, thinking, really believing on some level the dog understands this whole thing you're saying to them, even if it's very confusing, but then describing in your funny way what the dog is probably not going to do or is doing, and it's great. It's delightful. It's so great. I mean, if people did nothing, it's, you know what it's like? It's like the verbal equivalent of looking at a lot of New Yorker cartoons. That's exactly what it is. You've written the cartoon, the caption for their cartoon, and then you describe
it. These are captions. Yes, it's true. If only my drawing were better, I could do the whole thing.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. It's like cartoons. So I mentioned briefly the trouble with breeds chapter, but the thing that also jumped out at me is something that is a pet desire of mine or question of mine that no one is raising. And you raise it here with the guy from the AKC who says, we need to produce, we as a country, if you will, in terms of supply and demand, 8 to 10 million dogs a year. That's how many people, American families or individuals, are going to want. And as you point out in the book, there's, call it 4 to 5 million in the shelters. And that's not counting the fact that many people want a puppy. So having written this chapter and looked so carefully into how breeding is done and why it's been done and where it's gone wrong and why crossbreeding and outbreeding has actually always been done until it wasn't, and that it's for the health of the dogs, what would your, at the end of the chapter, you say, come on, people, crossroads, we got to do something here. But what does the individual do who really wants a puppy? So what do you think, as a person who studied this?
Yeah, I mean, that's a $1 million question, right? So is there an answer? My guess is there's not one solution, right?
Okay.
So first of all, society has to make, we have to make some change. And maybe the first change we make is not the thing that will be, maybe it will just be something for the next 10 or 20 years, right? For the next couple of generations. And then maybe some other change will happen. Mm-hmm. But there's some easy first changes we could make societally. One is, you know, changing the nature of breed standards such that when purebred dogs are bred, if we're going to continue all that, as you mentioned, you know, there's outbreeding or crossbreeding, and that dogs are being bred for health.
Yes,
just
there's
breed
the word.
Dogs for health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That would be a major change. We'd still get all these beautiful dogs. You'd still get a diverse variety of dogs. You could still be buying dogs, and that's another question, whether we should be buying, you know, and selling dogs. But that would be a good first step. You know, in addition, I think I love the way that rescue dogs have been now kind of heralded. You know, people
Yes.
are excited to have a rescue dog, and I think that's very good. But I think some step needs to happen as well, where we start to change what we think of the rescue dog population even more. So people still think that if you want a dog, you have to, like, where do people go to get a dog? They go to a breeder who says they have a type of dog that has a type of behavior that will look a certain way. And then the rescue dog is thought of as like the dog that needs to be saved, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're probably an abused mm-hmm. dog. They've had a traumatic background, you know, and that, of course, that's often not the case, right?
There's very
too
often.
Many puppies.
Right.
And so this whole notion of one as this, it was introduced with pure breeding in the 19th century. Some dogs are pure dogs, good dogs, reliable dogs, and others are kind of like adulterated bad dogs, you know, that now we want to, as a society, save, which I'm not against that, but we need to change that. That the understanding of who these dogs are has to radically change, because a mixed breed dog is probably, you know, everything else being equal, probably a healthier dog than a inbred dog. You know, most of them, as you say, don't come from traumatic backgrounds. So that we have this whole mythology of what a dog should be. And I think that needs to be overturned.
Well, we also do have the problem, as you said, heralded are the rescue dogs and the fine people like you or me, or, you know, the 17 friends we have. Oh, I have a rescue dog. Like, that makes us special. We're great. We're special. We're morally superior. And a mm-hmm. great deal of stigma in those same circles. You're very funny about New York. The Upper East Side has the little dogs. The Upper West Side has mm-hmm. labs. And then Brooklyn and groovy places have mixed breeds because that's cool. And they're all rescues in theory. But
yeah.
the moral presumption that it's immoral to buy, that it's immoral to have a purebred. Now, of course, that doesn't hold in those enclaves of, excuse me, say Palm Beach. I have no idea. That is not meant as a diss on Palm Beach. But there are areas where people have a lot of wealth and they expect to have certain kinds of dogs that have always been in their families, let's say. We've always had yeah. these kinds of dogs, let's say. But there can't be a stigma on buying dogs when there aren't enough secondhand dogs, if you will, dogs for rehoming to go around. And there are people who want puppies. So I still go back to what's the practical solution to that? We can't mass produce them in Missouri and have them go through middlemen, but that's what we're doing, kind of the internet. You said, where do people get dogs? They get them off the internet, even
right.
shelter dogs. It's all on the internet, all of it mixed
right.
up.
Well, it very much goes back to the question of the property status of dogs. I think, I mean, in some way, the biggest, although it's not, you know, it's kind of not the most exciting topic in some ways. It was the one that I was wound up being the most excited about, was the fact that dogs are simply considered to the law property, chattel property, you know, worth, as I compare it in the book, you know,
a
the
chair.
Price of a chair.
Yeah.
Not a very good chair either, right? Because the price you paid for my dog, I paid to get him out of the shelter.
Right.
You know, it's less than $100. And my ergonomic chair is, you know, probably twice that. So
right.
that's their value. That's what they're worth. If your dog were accidentally killed or hurt, or intentionally, that's what you get. You get like a replacement value. And if we consider dogs property that can be bought and sold, that have no value, that have no rights, whose well-being we don't have to actually take into account as a society, except for these small animal cruelty laws, which only reify their status as property and don't really affect most of the cruelty that is put upon dogs, then we're not doing justice to dogs. Then we're not giving them the dignity they deserve. Then we're not paying them back for being our companions by respecting, you know, their well-being and the things they need and honoring that. I think the breeding goes back to that thing, you know. And so there is a broader question to which I do not have the answer, and I'm happy to not. I mean, it's a discussion that should involve many minds, not
right.
just one mind.
Right.
Which is, like, how should they be property that we can just buy and sold and use, buy and sell and use, and always be able to get a new one when we want? Like, you and I, by the end of this conversation, could go and buy 10 more dogs. We're allowed to do that, even if we can't take care of them. We don't have the money for it. We don't want them. We're not equipped. We know nothing about dogs. We're still allowed to go and buy 10 dogs in the next half hour. And that seems to me to be an abuse of our relationship with this animal.
Well, see, that's where you become so morally interesting to me, and I think to anybody reading our dogs ourselves, is that you take an idea that seems to be one we can grasp, and then you take it to what to you is the logical conclusion. And I don't disagree with it, but as I was reading, I was thinking, but people don't need any training to be parents to little humans, and they can have as many as they want, and nobody,
yeah.
and the children are abused regularly, and I don't mean horrible physical abuse, all the other kinds, you know. Busy, exhausted, stressed out, strung out parents of every class, middle to upper, to lower to whatever. So I think that the vulnerable and defenseless that are in our lives that we take on a kind of paternalistic, maternalistic relationship to, we're ill-equipped for all of it. I don't think it's only the animals.
You're right. No, and to say that it is the animals isn't to say it is only the animals, right? And I never see it as a...
Either
only
or.
Have a certain amount
right.
of resources for thinking about this or
right.
energy to put into developing a good program, we should put it into animals, not people. We don't have a finite amount of
right.
energy
good
or
point.
Thinking. And so we can use the things that we do, which are salutary for children, like if there is a highly irresponsible parent, children are taken from the home, right? And say we might say, well, social services should be better, you know, those people should be better trained. We should definitely, you know, there could be criticisms of the way the program is set up, but there is a program in place to take children from homes where they're not being taken care of, right? Where there are neglectful parents. So you're right. Yeah, you don't have to have any training to be a parent. The government has decided that they could take over, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is some system in place for that. And furthermore, we're talking about a dependent who will grow up to be independent.
Correct.
With a dog,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about a dependent who will always be a dependent.
Correct.
Who is just, you know, in our custody.
At our mercy.
Their whole life.
Yeah.
And our mercy, dependent on us for everything they do. When is it time to eat? When can you pee? When can you walk? When can you see other dogs? When can you have company? All the things we dictate about all their days. And so that kind of demands a different solution. So I think we can use the children model in interesting ways to explore the differences and similarities, but I don't think it's one or the other, that we have to put our resources into one or the other.
Good
or
point.
If we're doing badly with children, we should also do badly with dogs.
Right.
Or
maybe
doing badly with children.
Right.
We should improve how we do with children.
Right. And also maybe take some of that and apply it possibly to other dependents that have four legs. Just be
that's right.
Be kinder, be more patient, be more generous. I mean, the people that rush a child along instead of letting it dawdle, it's
yeah.
always been your contention about dogs. The walk is for them. If they want to stop and sniff, it's not about hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And we've all done the hurry up. Come on, I need to walk you. You need to, as if the dogs were wearing Fitbits. You need so many steps a day, guy.
That's right.
But the dog needs so many sniffs a day, really.
Yep. And I feel that way about my child, too. You know, I want him to have his child life.
Yes.
And although sometimes we have to hurry him along. Sometimes he has to get to school. He has to put up with this. He's in society. A lot of other times, the main thing I do as a parent is let him be childlike and try to follow his lead.
Which and makes you highly unusual. Highly unusual and very sane.
It's not hard to do either, right? I'm not holding myself up as a paragon parent. That's what I'm interested in with a child, and that's what I'm interested in with a dog, too.
Yeah, and I think that's the chapter called Against Sex, which I didn't know this, but you've had all kinds of social media blasting. How wonderful that I don't read social media at all. But apparently people have bashed you and gotten all up in your face and unfriended you. And like, who wanted to have a friend anyway who can't take new ideas and put them to use? But your thoughts on the issue of spay neuter. Again, I think it's going to be one thing when I'm reading the chapter. And if I read it and reread it, it has so many layers. And some of them have to do with your belief that a dog should have as much freedom as is socially tolerable to express their dogness in every possible way, to have some choice, right? Is it, do you think part of it has to do with you feel dogs, or you not even feel, you believe and see that dogs have very little choice in any part of their life?
Yeah, as we were expressing with this other topic, they are dependent on us for the things even they're going to do, right? Their breathing is at their own pace, but are they going to be able to eat now? Well, they have to wait for us. Are they going to be able to urinate? Well, they have to wait for us. Are they allowed to see that other dog who they're interested in? Well, we'll just have to see if we decide.
Right.
So
right.
Some choices is an easy way to improve welfare of our dogs. And as respects their neuter, I think the biggest issue for me, which I think is worth discussing, is that spay neuter policies appeared to solve a human problem, which is that we created too many dogs and we didn't keep track of them. You know, we didn't hold on to them. We didn't try to, if we let them have puppies, we weren't concerned ahead of time about whether we would be able to have home for those puppies. And
right.
So there were just millions of dogs being euthanized every year. And this was an attempt to solve that. What's interesting to me is that to solve it, we haven't really changed our behavior. We still let ourselves do those things.
Mm-hmm.
Although societally, we have changed in ways. We don't let dogs run as much, at least in some parts of the U.S., run free. And instead, we ask dogs to solve the problem for us by surgically de-sexing them. And I'm fascinated by that little non sequitur that we do as a society. They say, oh, yeah, it's, you know, and the way to be responsible as an owner is to have your dog spayed and neutered, as though that then
right.
is your responsibility as an owner. And furthermore, it's the dog who's bearing the responsibility. And then there are all these systemic repercussions from losing the reproductive organs, which also hold all these hormones, which have brain functions, which lead to bone and muscle growth.
Mm-hmm.
So we have done that. So I want to look at that and say, oh, why are we seeing this as it's not a solution to the problem. It hasn't been a solution.
That's right.
And furthermore, it has these repercussions. And third, this is a human problem. It's our problem. We have to solve our behavior. It's not the dog's problem. And so why are we asking them to solve it for us?
You put it so well now, but also in the book, and that word, responsible ownership, I've never questioned it. I've definitely questioned spay-neuter, and anybody that reads what I write or listens to the show knows that back, if you guys have been listening since whatever it has been, 14 years ago, there was a gal called Parveen Farhoudi who came on the show, and she had found the clinical work of a veterinarian called Christine Zink, who had found a correlation, and we're talking the dark ages of research compared to the kind of work that's being done now. A positive correlation of some two very negative things. Dogs that were not neutered or spayed had much lower cancer and much lower joint problems, from arthritis to the ACL tears, which are a devastating injury, a devastating surgery and recovery. The dog's, you know, basically never the same. And the cancer issue is the one that you didn't even go into in great detail, but after reading your book, I thought, well, hang on. If cancer rates have soared in the last few decades, and everyone's going, it's got to be the food, which is illogical, because you can't get cancer. I mean, even if children ate hot dogs full of horrible nitrates and nitrites every day, they don't get cancer. And quality commercial dog food is not cancer-causing. But cancer is an epidemic. But what have we done at the same time? We have not only spayed and neutered at 6 months, which is way too young. It's now been found by those that are investigating it. But we spay and neuter at 6 and 8 weeks. We are making eunuchs of little teeny tiny creatures whose brains and bodies can never develop normally. And I think that that is the unintended consequence, is these horrible systemic problems and other things they're discovering too, as you mentioned, other, you know, metabolic problems. The body's never, and the brain are never allowed to grow properly. So we've created this as the thing to do to be responsible. But as you point out in this chapter, who calls that responsible? You just do that and that makes you responsible? Just like with breeders, you talk about responsible breeders. What does that mean?
Right.
I mean,
isn't it also so interesting that that spay neuter is convenient for us, right? Like, we don't want our dogs to have these children in our family.
Right.
We don't want them to be sexual, right? We don't want them to be humping.
Yep.
We don't want them to be, you know, have that salacious glint in their eye looking at another dog. We don't want them to sniff each other too closely, you know, sniffing potentially for reproductive status. It's messy to have, you know, I've had it described to me numerous times by vets that, you know, menses is messy and we don't want to deal with it. And I think, well, right.
We women do that a lot.
It's so fascinating. Of course it is. I suppose, would we want to eliminate all the biological features of ourselves because it's just simpler? Well, are we doing that with our dogs? And it's just like a secondary nice thing about spay neuter, about this policy, which was ostensibly to solve the problem of our population, that now we don't have to worry about having sexual creatures in our house. I find that a fascinating thing to look at. As a person who, I should say too, never had an agenda about this, always lived with dogs who were spayed or neutered, and never, and very much believed what I was told, that this, by my veterinarians, by society at large, that this was the responsible thing to do. So it's very interesting to just look a little further at where it came up, what its effects are, what are the side effects of our doing it for dogs and for us, and to try to open a conversation and find that some people are delighted to have a conversation. Thank you, Tracy. You are. Some people won't even go past the headline and will condemn me. Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing to me.
If you can't even discuss the topic,
yes, then I don't know. I mean, I'm just in it for the dogs.
Well
right?
said.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't know the only answer. I don't have the single answer I think we should apply. But I do think that we as a society have not applied the single correct answer. It's at least worth looking at. And that's all I want to do.
That's what you do all the time. You're constantly holding up a mirror and saying, here's what we're doing. Here's why we used to do certain things. Here's what the consequence of those things is. Now we're at a point where we can also exert influence, make different choices. I remember when I did a whole lot of shows called The Pet Cancer Vet on my Radio Pet Lady Network with Sue Ettinger, who's called The Pet Cancer Vet. Great gal. Her lab died. She buys puppies, as so many of us do. It's okay. You can buy puppies, people. It's America. It used to be a free place. I don't know what it is now, but you can still buy puppies. So she gets a puppy from the same breeder she always has and has her spayed at 6 months. And then I'm saying, what'd you do to Virginia? You're a cancer doctor. And somehow she had not caught up with that literature. And boy, did she feel bad. Now, I kept Wanda intact till she was 14 months old, and she had to wear little panties. They only come into heat like twice a year. I thought it was rather funny, actually. And she runs free. But there aren't any unneutered males around, certainly not in Vermont. So, you know, what was going to happen? They were curious and interested, and she snarled and snapped at them. So that sort of solved that. But then I thought, okay, that's the magic number, 14 months, but maybe it should have been 5, 10 years. We don't honestly know. None of us in America has really seen intact males. If you see one, you're like, oh, that's terrible. Didn't you say that in your class in the book? You said, what if somebody had a male dog with balls, and people went, oh, terrible. You know, like young people.
And many had never seen.
Yes.
My college students hadn't seen an intact male.
Yep.
And you think, well, that's really fascinating. I did have an interesting comment at a recent event. A woman who said, you know, I walk my dog in Central Park, which is this, you know, off-leash hour. It's a huge park in New York. Before 9 o'clock, you have off-leash animals. And if there's a unneutered male, all the dogs act bananas around this male, you know, and they all are interested in him. Like, if we had all unneutered males, it would just be chaos. We couldn't do it. And I was fascinated by that. What's happened is that now the dog who has their normal hormones is exceptional, so everybody's interested. But then we're worried.
Oh, they'll all be like
everyone
that.
Had their hormones.
Yeah. Where would we be? It'd be like humans. We'd be having all these impulses that we would have to learn to control.
And I think that, yes, we might have to make some changes, but it would be also more normal, right? And we'd also
Correct.
Learn to deal with that, which is what we used to as a society. There were unneutered males. You know, spay neuter is a very recent phenomenon. Vets weren't spaying and neutering. 100 years ago was not common practice at all. But now it's just changed partly how we deal with dogs. And just making these things more visible is worthwhile for people who are interested in thinking about these companions who we adore and who give us so much.
If you left out the part that Alexandra talks about, is them having the free expression of humping if they feel like it. It doesn't have to result in copulation or in babies. Just, you know, that freedom of expression. We're a puritanical, uptight culture. We are so uptight. So it's like, oh my God, the dog's penis came out of its sheath. I grew up with an intact Bedlington Terrier. I was interested in your breeding chapter to find out it was one of the four original terrier breeds, which is weird because it's such an oddball looking dog. Darling. But he was intact. We're talking the 1950s. Dogs were totally not spayed or neutered. He was so terrible because he was terrible, Pango. He attacked other dogs. He fought other dogs. Everybody was intact, so it was irrelevant. He would have done that with or without his testicles, I'm sure. But if you look at dogs in dog shows, who by the laws of dog shows must be intact, they they don't raise an eyebrow to each other. You're just not supposed to have a female in heat because it's really asking too much of the boys to keep their penis in the sheath, quite frankly. But otherwise, the guys, like, they're all clanging their balls around and just ignoring each other. It's their normal.
Yes, it's become normal for them, and they deal with it, and we would deal with it too. And to be totally clear, I'm not saying, and I don't want anybody listening to your show to say, like, oh, she's saying nobody should spay neuter, or only certain people should spay neuter. I'm saying, like, how weird is it that we've gotten in this situation where if you're breeding dogs, you don't. You're allowed to make as many more as you want. If you're getting a rescue dog, they come spay neutered. And we've just accepted all this as the way it has to be and the way it should be. And I'm saying it doesn't have to be this way, and maybe it shouldn't be this way.
And questioning it, simply saying to people, let's stop and think. If you knew that by even delaying spay-neuter for a large breed dog till after 12 months of age, when even the growth plates haven't closed, their limbs still have not fully formed, but they've got brain chemicals that have helped them develop certain attitudes and ideas, just the size of their brain even, but in particular, their immune system. If you knew that you could lower your chance of cancer, all of us who have lived through one dog after another dying at 6, 8, 10, 12 years old of horrible cancers, would you not make that choice? If you knew it and someone gave you the choice?
What's also hard is that it's the research to say which breeds, what age.
Right,
you know,
right.
Developing, right?
Yes.
It's a research program in process.
Absolutely.
So we aren't always going to have the perfect answer, but we do have some information now thanks to the vets who have done the work and done the labor and looked through, you know, all the past animals under their care and in the databases, that should start to inform us, and we can support that research and get more information so then individuals can make a choice that's right for their dog.
Well said. Frankly. Well said. To any of you listening who any of this raises your ire, good. Stop and think about what we're doing. Think about it differently. Think outside the box. Think down the road. Think back to history. It's what a great thinker like Alexandra will do for you, is stimulate you to not just take everything as this is how it is, status quo, this is the right way. There's lots of ways. Our dogs, ourselves, the story of a singular bond, is an incredible contribution to our society, whether or not you live with dogs. It tells you how a really smart person thinks. And I think, Alexandra, you encourage all of us to be smarter people. I'll also say one other thing, which I thought of often when reading this book, and even in reading your other books, is I think back to the great line of JFK's, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I feel you do that with our dogs. Don't ask what your dog can do for you, how it can make you happy and fulfilled. What can you do for your dog to make them happy and fulfilled?
So that's brilliant.
Thank you very, very, very much. I only wish that I could go back in time only to be able to be a student in your classes. I bet it's thrilling. So keep up all your great work. And if anybody has anything nay to say, say it, please, with respect and kindness, never unpleasantly, because that is the bane of social media. No rudeness allowed, right?
I wish.
Well, I wish too. Thank you so much for being here. It's always a great pleasure. I'll be right back after this quick word. This show is brought to you in part by Iceland Pure, a privately owned company that guarantees freshness and purity in their human-grade omega-3 fish oils for pets. Odor-free salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils responsibly sourced in the clean waters of Iceland and Norway. Now they have added Next Level Premier fish oil, which contains shark oil for the first time. Sold only in independent pet stores or with a 10% discount directly from the company website, the health benefits of shark oil have been documented. For more information about the research about the healing powers of shark oil, please go to RadioPetLady.com or Iceland Pure's website. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, freshly made dog food shipped to your door. Evermore is owned by two women who are so serious about human-grade ingredients that they actually ate Evermore pet food themselves for a whole month. Hannah and Allison make their food by conscientiously selecting fresh organic vegetables mixed with fresh, humanely raised beef, lamb, chicken, and turkey to make nutritionally balanced dog food. After low-temperature cooking, the sealed pouches are frozen and shipped right to your home to be served as a complete meal or as part of your pet's diet. I am here with the Hamptons' most wonderful filmmaker. He's not from the Hamptons. It's the single most wonderful movie I've ever seen set in the Hamptons. The stars are two French poodles. Sean Cassels, you made Bitches at the Beach, also known as Chien à la Plage. I don't know which you prefer as your title. It is so hilariously funny. It is such a send-up of what two chicks from New York go through when they spend a weekend in the Hamptons trying to do it and be it all. Where did the inspiration for this movie come from?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the love for it. It came from the writer Kendra Cunningham and I were brainstorming ideas for what kind of project we wanted to do next. And we happened to have an adorable puppy in our family named Ellie. She's a mini Labradoodle. And our favorite DP and co-director, Adam Evans, had just gotten Zuma, who's a Frenchton. And both dogs had just this great personalities, and they were really, well, I don't want to say trained, but they were just very good listeners and very still. and they just had these great personalities. I thought it'd be funny if they were a bunch of, I hate saying this term, but they were a bunch of millennials on their way out
for
a bachelorette weekend in the Hamptons, you know. Montauk and Amagansett being overrun by parties every weekend.
Yeah, ruined, destroyed, all that.
We wanted to tap into that. And Kendra, who's a stand-up comedian herself, loved it. So we hashed out what it would be, like what they would do in the Hamptons. And she said, you know, what would they do? Because I've been out in the Hamptons My family has had a place out there. My mom lives out there full time now.
No kidding! Oh my God, I didn't even know that. Really? Where does she live?
Yeah.
Which town?
She's in Southampton, right off Route 27. I won't give the address.
No, no, we are not going to make people come to your mother's door to look for an autograph for you. Doesn't seem fair.
But we've been there since the 80s, and I worked at Plum TV back in the day. And
Some
lovely people I work with out there. You know, I enjoy working with the Southampton Art Center and the parish and Tracy Mitchell and Sag Harbor's Bay Street. So I just love the Hamptons, and we had this place to film the dogs, and you know, we were trying to decide, would it be a world of humans and the dogs are on a leash? Or would it be a world where it's all animals? And it was just so much funnier to have it just animals only.
I'll say.
And that was like the genesis of it was, you know, just all these people coming out there and partying, and yet they get out there and they don't know what to do. They have this big list of stuff.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, then I take back my introduction because I didn't think you were. I couldn't figure out how you could be so in the know on the under the radar, over the radar of knowing what that experience is like. Of course, you couldn't know it as a dog or as a millennial female going for a girl's weekend. But now I know why. I mean, you've watched it. Oh, my goodness. You've watched it more than me. When I first moved out there, it was 1993, and it still seemed like sleepy, charming towns. And first I lived in Southampton and then in East Hampton. And it took about a decade for it to all just, whatever you want to call it, explode, implode, become Ralph Laurenville. And it was like, wow, what happened here? And these two dogs are such a great example of what happened, but with so much humor. Tell a little bit about Kendra as a stand-up comic. She wrote it. She's brilliant. Wow.
She's wonderful. She's a wonderful stand-up comic. I'm lucky to be her partner in life as well.
And, oh, nice.
A couple shorts that were out at the Broad Humor Fest. One was called Neighborhood Network that both Adam and I worked with her on. And she's doing another one with her friend Leah Bonema called The Dawns. And it's about two Boston women who are running a block. Their name, both names are Dawns, D-A-W-N, but
yep,
they're Dawns, like Dawns in the Mafia, and they're running a block in Boston. And it's very, like, very old-school Boston. Kendra's from Boston. And she does stand-up throughout New York City. In October, she's doing a little bit in London. She's doing her first, like, light European tour. And actually, for those who are in the New England area, I believe she's in November going to be not only in Boston but in New Hampshire as well.
Oh my gosh! Well, too bad we don't have enough time. We could have her do a little stand up intro, warm up the audience before the Dog Film Festival. That would be amazing. Well, you know, it's so funny that people amazing that people can wear so many different creative hats and pull off something like this film, which is clearly a labor of love and joy and not a ticket, just like anything in the Dog and Cat Film Festivals, not exactly a ticket to fame and fortune, but done with such seriousness of purpose, although in your case, a hilarious movie. How do you finance? How do you fund these projects? They seem like complete labors of love, and if you didn't have a Dog Film Festival or maybe some other shorts film festival, how would people have the joy of seeing it? How do you have the courage or the conviction to think, I'm going to make this and I'll find an audience?
You know what? It's for both Kendra and I, and I would say Adam and our co-producer, Ed Christensen, it's just, we're constantly coming up with ideas, and we can't not do them. We think about them all the time. And so we find others who are in the same vein as us and team up with our equipment and our personal time. And we do this for us. We do this because
we
think this is funny and we love it. We're certainly not making a lot of money off of this. we all kind of work in corporate world and do like some agency stuff.
I see.
Things like that to make ends meet. And we love doing that. We love our clients. But when we get a chance to do something that's really funny, or we find like really great scripts, and Kendra's like is a brilliant writer.
I'll say.
She has a great way with dialogue.
Yeah.
And Adam is the best DP I've ever worked with. I've been around the world with him. He's very talented with the camera in his hand, and as a director. So we just like hanging out with each other. And so I just feel like I've always been doing that, even since I was younger. It's a funny little story is, he didn't get it edited. I edited this piece, but there's one of the lead editors on The Bachelor for ABC. His name is Tim Bartlett.
Okay.
And he was going to edit this for us, but of course The Bachelor season came up and he's literally sleeping in his edit suite there. And he's like, I can't do it. But he was giving me little tidbits on, you know, this cut would work a little bit better.
Really?
That one.
Really?
Very helpful.
So you have a whole canoe of people that just appreciate independent, I guess, filmic, artistic expression. I mean, just as...
Yeah.
For you guys, it's an extension of your thought process, your creative process. It sounds like, you know, Spielberg Young, right, who started out with some handheld 8mm something or another. A lot of great filmmakers always saw the world through the lens of film and just were able to express themselves. I'm just amazed that in the modern world where everyone's so busy and things, I mean, of course, your time is quote-unquote free, but everything else seems to cost a lot, that people can just follow that passion. I wish that we could do a clip from the movie on the air, but that doesn't make any sense. You got to come to the Dog Film Festival on November 3rd and see it. But how did you get the dogs to – you're saying they were good listeners and good at sitting still. There was quite a lot of shots of them on beach chairs on a big, wide beach, which was probably Southampton, maybe near your mom's house. Who knows? It looked like a very nice, quiet, duny, wide, gorgeous Southampton-y beach.
It's right. It's not Old Town Beach. It's the beach next to it. I believe it's, not Fields. But it's one down from Old Town. We figured there'd be less people, and it's late June. So it's windy and not as many people out there. People haven't hit. I think all the tennis courts and the pool stuff were... near my mom's. We woke up like at dawn when we knew there'd be no one and no one would get in, we wouldn't get in trouble.
Right.
with people having dogs and a camera out there and stuff. We were very patient. We just filmed and filmed and filmed. You know, they'd get up and we'd let them run around a lot and get their energy out. And so that they would eventually just be like, all right, we're really tired. We're just going to lay here. So the credit sequence is a bit of that running around energy, and I just kind of wanted to put that towards the end. That very last shot is literally what we would let them do before we filmed anything. And during that, Adam would get stills with the dogs, and that's when their personalities would come out. Before each segment, we have a little still image with an explanation, a little scene name in French.
Yes.
And the funniest part was, you know, the first shot we did was the pool, and it was just supposed to be them in the beach chairs. And Ellie had been to the beach before, but she'd never been to the pool, and she's certainly never been in the water fully before. And we're like, all right, we're going to sit them there. And she takes a while to dry and walked in there, and she went right in and jumped in the pool. And she had never swam before, so it shocked me. And just the look in her face is, what did I do? She went right in the deep end. And she was swimming, and she was fine. And of course, I jumped in, and I grab her and push her out, because there's no way to get out. But it's just, she's just the fearlessness.
She's a born actress. That puppy's a born actress.
She is. She's got the little eye movements she does. She's always very still, but she really has this funny personality. She's very smart.
So what does that tell you about professionally trained dog actors who often look so fake. No offense to y'all that are dog trainers, but, you know, you can see the dog looking all perky-eared over the shoulder of the actor. It's like an over-the-shoulder shot, and we know they're looking at the trainer who's probably giving them a hand signal. But your girls were not looking to someone to tell them what to do next. They were being themselves, and you captured that. And then, of course, Kendra's script of what these dogs are saying to each other is so, it's sort of like a, I don't know, this is going to sound nutty, it's sort of like a 70s Valley Girl, but transposed to, you know, the 21st century New York City babes, young babes trying to figure out how to be cool and with it and get to all the right places wearing the right outfits and a weekend in the Hamptons.
Her writing is that minutia that is in every conversation. It's not forced. It's just how people talk. It's a real skill. She's really good at it. It's kind of like how David Mann has his style of just finding that, you know, that little staccato beat he has in there. She's really good at writing dialogue. It's just incredible.
They do seem like they seem like bitches at the beach or bitches going to the beach. I just mean female people, but in this case, it's dogs who are legitimately just bitches. And overhearing them on the jitney, which they take out, and or in the Uber, overhearing them and thinking, oh my God, listen to these two, and then they're dogs. Oh, yeah. It's so adorable.
The only regret I have is we don't have them actually on the jitney, but it's having been on the jitney many times and the train out there, it's quite an experience when it's high season. So the franticness of everyone getting off, and it's not just the young kids, it's all ages getting off are frantic and crazy and excited to be out there. But in terms of like the storyline, you know, I think having done some commercial stuff ourselves, when they have the dog in there, they have it for a few minutes and they got to get to the next shot. There's money and they, you know, we got to get to the next shot or we're going to lose this day and we're going to lose money.
Right.
So they're forced to take the shot. We got to let the dogs tell us kind of the story. You know, we knew where we wanted to hit the beats with them. We knew where we wanted them to walk to, but we kind of let their eyes and stuff do that. So Kendra had written a basic script. And then when we put the edit together and watched their footage, we'd notice, you know what, she's looking really nervous here. Or she did something really funny, like in the tennis scene, she just kind of, Ellie does this really funny looking up and moving off the camera.
Yeah.
And so just trying to work those really comedic actions the dog had that are very human. I think that's the biggest thing is it's very human.
It is.
Though when they have those little moments. And their eyes really, both their eyes really tell the story, which is what adds more than just a dog staring at something. They're looking around. They're trying to see stuff. So we spent hours filming them.
Well, I guess
a
that
real labor of love in the edit.
Yes, and you can see that's really where the joy is that you really enjoyed the process and the dogs enjoyed the process. Really look forward to seeing you on November 3rd, and sorry that the dog girls can't come because the theater can't allow any dogs, but I sure would love them to walk the green carpet, but maybe we'll find another venue where we can do that.
Absolutely.
You take care.
They're always looking for stuff.
In fact, all right, thanks so much for being here. I look forward to seeing you on November 3rd along with everybody else who's listening. We'll all be there. Take care. This show is brought to you in part by Iceland Pure Omega-3 Fish Oils for Pets. Odor-free, human-grade salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils from responsibly sourced fish. Freshness and purity are guaranteed with the proprietary aluminum pump bottles and fish from the clean rivers and oceans of Iceland and Norway. This show is also brought to you by Evermore Pet Food, wholly owned by two women, Hannah in Brooklyn and Allison in California, who combine organic vegetables and humanely raised beef, lamb, chicken, and turkey for freshly made, nutritionally balanced pet foods that are low temperature cooked in pouches, then shipped frozen right to your home to be served as a complete meal or as part of your pet's meals. And this show is also brought to you by Zymox Dermatology Products, ear solution, topical cream, and topical spray for skin conditions. All the Zymox skin calming products share a patented LP3 enzyme system, which works to prevent or reduce inflammation and to gently heal skin irritations. available from your veterinarian or at pet specialty retailers.